Last week, when time ran out, we were in 2 Kings 3, verse 27, where it describes the king of Moab in utter exasperation and defeat, taking his eldest son, who would have reigned in his place, and offering him as a burnt offering on the wall. And it says there was great indignation against Israel. So they departed from him and returned to their own land. And we were talking about the difficulty of the passage and then referred to an article in Biblical Archaeology Review back in the 80s that had some knowledge about various occasions like this where a nation's basically defeated. In fact, they are defeated. And it was pretty much understood that as a last resort, they could get the enemy to leave by a shock effect when they would stand and sacrifice their oldest son in the front of the enemy and cause them to have this terrified reaction to this and leave. And the time ran out, and Steve came up to me after we were through last week, and he said, and you want to take over, Steve? Not that. It shuts them down, which I thought was an excellent illustration of this same thing. Any other comments on this? Okay, just a few things in conclusion. Does anybody remember what the Moabite stone says? Why would the Moabite stone be valuable for a Christian to know about? No memory? Well, how many of you had never heard of the Moabite stone before? So some had, some had not. Okay. Well, it basically is King Mesha's account of several things, but including this battle that we're reading of here. It is set in the time and frame that we see in the Old Testament. So the chronology of the Old Testament, contrary to the Discovery Channel, meshes with Mesha's account of what's taking place and when it occurred, what occurred, and what took place. And he's very clear in what he says. He doesn't claim victory, but he does show that he was delivered from the Israelites by his god Chemosh on this day. And it is speculated that the way he was delivered was by sacrificing his son. It had such a horrifying effect upon those who saw it, they lost their taste for battle and got out of there. So the battle demonstrates the power of God and the vanity of idols. Baal or Chemosh or any of the other gods couldn't help them. Yet the sad thing is Israel themselves would go on to worship these same gods and go on themselves to engage in the kind of child sacrifice that we see here. Turn over to 2 Kings chapter 16 for just a minute. This takes us to the reign of Ahaz in Judah. Now this is not Israel. Israel's already coming to the end by this point. But this is Judah. And it tells us in 2 Kings 16:3, but he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Indeed, he made his son pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel. The reason Joshua led the children of Israel into this land to conquer it in the first place included the fact they were guilty of slaying their children as sacrifices to gods. Now, here's one in Judah who's doing the same thing. Then in chapter 21, another king. It's amazing how many occasions you have a really, really sorry father who gives birth, his wife gives birth to a very good son, then the son gives birth to a very bad son. Again, that's the case here. Hezekiah is the father of Manasseh, and he reigned 55 years. And it tells us in verse 2, he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. It mentions, and I'm not going to read all these, he built altars to the various gods. But in verse 6, he made his son pass through the fire, practiced soothsaying, that's fortune telling, used witchcraft, and consulted spiritists and mediums. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. He even set a carved image of Asherah that he had made in the house which the Lord God had said to David and Solomon his son, that this is the house that I've chosen to put my name there. And so every way he could go wrong, he went wrong. He was one of the sorriest of the sorry till he was taken away into Babylonian captivity, at which time he got a come to meet God moment and repented and was restored back to his old place and tried to undo a lot of his damage, but then it was too late. It wasn't going to help very many people. So that sets the scene for the downfall of the people of Judah. Though they're in the right in opposing Moab, though they have a good king in Jehoshaphat, all it takes is one bad king and a very short time, and they will go south just as the others have done. So this takes us back then to 2 Kings 4, where we're ready to look at a couple of women and some prophets here. I would say in the heading of this chapter, I would entitle it Overcoming Slavery, Death, and Food Poisoning. Those would be the things that are discussed. And it'll be a collection. Chapter 4 is a collection of Elisha's miracles that he worked. And you see several of these grouped together in various places. In chapter 4, verse 1, a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor is coming to take my two sons to be his slaves." Well, a couple of things about this. Let me get past this little review of the Moabite stone. There's the map. We'll come back to that in a minute. Child slavery was a very, very real possibility for poor families at this time. God, however, regulated what could take place and what could not take place during this period. They had to observe certain rules when children were sold into slaves. But to set the scene here in verse 1, here's a very good woman, apparently a fairly young woman, whose husband, a prophet, has died, and she has her sons here, her two sons, and she can't pay her debts. And when you can't pay your debts, the creditor has the right to come and say, "Well, I have to take whatever I can to get my money back." And in some cases, that turns out to be the sons who are sold as slaves. Now, three things about this. The harvest itself, the harvest rules, required certain things of the Israelites. When you're reaping your harvest, what was one of the rules that God set out for you to observe when you're reaping that harvest? You couldn't reap the corners. You can't cut corners. You have to leave those for the ones who are going to come after. And they can pick that up. And you see this illustrated very well in Ruth and some other folks who are there. Okay? Then in Leviticus 25, the law softens much of what would have happened in slavery had it not been for these laws. This is Leviticus 25, starting at verse 39. "And if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. As a hired servant and a sojourner, he shall be with you and shall serve you until the year of the Jubilee." Now let me add sort of an addendum to this. In Exodus 21, verse 2, he's to take him and he's to serve 7 years, sort of an indentured servitude, 7 years. But if the Jubilee comes first, he's released as soon as the Jubilee comes. So depending upon when the Jubilee comes, it could be maybe 1 year up to six. So he's saying here in verse 41, "Then he shall depart from you, he and his children with him, and shall return to his own family. He shall return to the possessions of his fathers, for they are my servants whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. You shall not rule over him with rigor." That means severity if you look at a footnote. "But you shall fear your God, And as for your male and female slaves whom you may have from the nations that are around you, from them you may buy male and female slaves, and moreover you may buy the children of the strangers, and if you do that, they can be a permanent possession, verse 46. That would be a blessing to the children who would come and be raised by a family in Israel and learn of the true God. Now, the third thing was charity was required. If you look at Deuteronomy chapter 15, it tells us in verse 7, if there is among you a poor man of your brethren within any of the gates in your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother, but you shall open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Now, you're to beware unless that you say, well, the seventh year of the year of release is here, I wouldn't have this service for very long, so I'm not going to do anything. You have to have a charitable heart. Matthew 5, talking about the love that God has for all you're to have, is based on passages such as this, Luke 14 and other passages that emphasize this thing. Charity was required. James 5, we'll go ahead and look at it now instead of going into detail in a moment. James 5 is rebuking certain rich men because they had not practiced this. They are always able to find loopholes. They're always able to find ways of not paying the poor for the work they've done. So, in James 5:1, come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will be a witness against you, and you will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out. He's saying the wages themselves get mouths and they start talking and say, we're supposed to belong to that person over there who did all this work, but this man cheated him and we're not going where we're supposed to go. And he says, they cry out. God hears them. The cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you. And so the farmer waits for the coming of the harvest, knowing that God's going to take care of him. He has to have patience in all this. So when you examine all this in the light of 2 Kings 4, we reach a couple of conclusions. Had the system of God worked, I really doubt these sons of this woman would have anything to fear, even if they were sold as slaves, because they would have been treated not with rigor, but with kindness, and would have been released at the proper moment. But also, there is the possibility of charity being given. And when charity is given, it could be she could have received what she needed without having to do anything. Apparently, that had not happened here. So in a land where people aren't paying attention to what God says with reference to the one true God, their fellow men are going to suffer. In any land where people aren't listening to the one true God, they're not going to listen to His word, they're not going to know how or even care to treat their fellow brothers in Israel. Does that make sense? That's what's happening here, apparently. So in verse 2, so Elisha said to her, what shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house? And she said, your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil, either sesame or olive, one of the two almost certainly. It was used for food and for fuel. Food and fuel. And it was very expensive. Well, he said, go borrow vessels from everywhere, from all your neighbors. Empty vessels. Do not gather just a few. In other words, bring in all the jars you can. When you've come in, you shall shut the door behind you and your sons, then pour it into all those vessels and set aside the full ones. You remember in 1 Kings 17, something similar to this, when Elijah goes to the widow of Zarephath and her oil is multiplied over and over and over. So a similar thing happening here. So she went forth from him and shut the door behind her, and her sons who brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out. Now it came to pass when the vessels were full that she said to her son, bring me another vessel. And he said to her, there is not another vessel. So the oil ceased. So here's the power of God at work, knowing exactly when to start multiplying. As often as it's poured, it's multiplied when it's going to another container. And then as soon as there is no other container, the oil stops just like that. So this shows the ability not only to have a very intelligent miracle, but it shows the ability to do the miracle at a distance. Elisha's not here. He's at a distance. It's kind of like the nobleman in John 4 who says, come see my son. He's sick. You go. He goes and he finds he was cured at the very hour when Jesus said he would be cured. Jesus could heal at a distance. That's what's being done here in these Old Testament passages as well. Now, verse 7, then she came and told the man of God, and he said, go, sell the oil and pay your debt, and you and your sons live on the rest. Now, several things about this. The expression in verse 3, he said, go borrow vessels, do not gather just a few. Which means what? What's the positive? Get a whole bunch. I guess the greater faith you have and the more people who are willing to lend them to you, the more you're going to get. Later on, when Joash, one of the kings of in the line of Jehu, the wild driver, is talking to Elisha, he has him open the window and he's to take an arrow and hit. And he hits three times. He says, oh, you should have hit a whole lot of times. Then you would have hit Syria until they were destroyed. Now you just win three victories. The greater the number, the better the victory. The greater the number, the greater the blessing. And so that's what he shows in all these things, in these miracles. A half-hearted, skeptical response hurts you more than it hurts anyone else. God's trying to bless you. So this oil would pay the debt. Faith does pay. If you have the oil, it's because you had the faith to get that oil. If you said, oh, I don't think anything like this will work. Let me find someone who knows what he's talking about. That Elisha's crazy. No, James 2, verse 5, tells us in very plain words that faith is something that is richly rewarded. Faith pays. James 2, 5, listen, my beloved brethren, has not God chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith? Here's this widow who was rich in faith. And heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him. And he goes on to talk about what faith does there. And notice also the expression that she uses when she talks about Elisha. You'll notice in verse 7, she came and told the man of God, the same expression used in chapter 1 of Elijah. You'll see this used repeatedly throughout the Old Testament. It's not man of Baal. It's not man of the calves. It's rather the man of God, because the others, false gods, couldn't have given this great blessing. And then verse 7, finally notice this parallel. This oil is just a little bit of oil, but miraculously it multiplies until all the need is met, plus some. What does that remind you of?
Wine.
I'm sorry?
Wine.
The multiplication of the wine in John 2? Another one? Ephesians 3:20, the promise he gives to us without even the benefit of a miracle. Anything else?
Loaves and the fishes.
And what happens with the loaves and the fishes? You have just 5 loaves, 2 fishes, right? And what happens? You feed how many men, not counting women and children? 5,000 men, not counting women and children. And then how many leftovers are there? More than they had to start with. Well, that's what's going on here. This is the same thing. So here's some parallels between those things you just named, what we see here. First of all, the people involved obeyed to the letter. She's told to go get as many containers as she can get. Why? She had never seen this happen before. She had to trust God, and her faith allowed her to be blessed exceedingly. What does Hebrews 11 say faith really amounts to? It pertains to things that are what? Sorry? Hope for. And it's things that we haven't even seen. Haven't even seen it take place. But we have faith in God who can do it. And then they did not understand what would happen. Even the disciples didn't understand what would happen. Here, take this and distribute. Okay, well, and it just keeps coming, it just keeps coming. She pours, and it just keeps pouring, and it just keeps pouring until there's nothing else to pour into. She didn't understand what would happen. She couldn't even explain it while it happened, except the power of God. The third thing, it was a test of faith, something that she hadn't seen. She had to trust and obey. It was the power of God. That's where Tim's Ephesians 3:20 comes up. And then the reward of faith. He's the rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. Hebrews 11, verse 6. Any comments before we go on?
Well,
Okay, in verse 8. Now, it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem. Let me see if we have a map that will get us. Yes. Oh, by the way, Shunem is this area right here. Here's Mount Carmel. It's somewhere between 17 and 25 miles. Don't know exactly, depending on where on Mount Carmel he is. But somewhere between 17 and 25 miles. Pretty good day's walk, but that's just one way. So we're talking about 4 or 5 hour, maybe 6 hour trip. We don't know exactly. But the guy who's leading the donkey for this woman is the one who's going to be exhausted more than anybody else. He has quite a chore involved. But verse 8 says, it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, literally a great woman. She had great faith, she had great wealth, she had great humility. Unlike the wife of the prophet, she's well off. She's a wealthy woman, and she has a husband. The prophet's wife was without him. He died. But she's content also, and yet she wants to help one of God's prophets. And she finds out in giving to one of God's prophets, she cannot outgive God. So it says she persuaded him, and it uses a term that's very strong. It means she insisted on it. She's like Lydia in Acts 16, 15. She insists that Paul and all of his helpers, Silas, Timothy, and Luke, go in and take of her hospitality. Oh, that's where this woman is with Elisha and Gehazi. And she persuaded him to eat some food. So it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in there to eat some food. So it's sort of a bed and breakfast. He's sort of a circuit rider, a circuit preacher at this point, who is going by this area regularly, and it's a good place to stop. And in verse 9, she said to her husband, "Look now, I know that this is a holy man of God." Notice, he's not just a man of God. He doesn't just wear a title. But he's a holy man of God. He's different. "Who passes by us regularly. Please, let us make a small upper room on the wall, and let us put a bed for him there, and a table and a chair and a lampstand, so it will be whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there." You know, we don't need a whole lot to get along in this life, do we? When you think about what he has a bed to sleep on, a chair to sit in, a table, and a light. What else do we really need? Now, I can hear people say, well, Twitter. He had Twitter. There were birds all around this area. And what about an air conditioner? Yes, he had a blanket. But when he's cold, he put it on. And when it's warm, he takes it off. So he has air conditioning. But we really don't need a whole lot of other things, do we? Then I see four things here very quickly. They build this house, this room on top of the house. It is a protection against the elements. It's a place for rest. Look at verse 11. He came there and he's lying in the bed as he's talking. Imagine he's lying there. He's talking to Gehazi, getting the feel from him before he asks her what he can do for her. And it shows he's with people. You know, when you stay out in the woods all the time and you're not with people, you start to walk a little strange. But he's with people, and that's a blessing in itself. And then he gets some home cooking. And it doesn't matter how much you camp out and enjoy it, home cooking has some things that can be said about it that other things cannot. So, he survived here without a cell phone, a TV, computer, or any other things that we need. Just these four little items in this room. And yet, he's so excited about what he's been given that he wants to do something for her. So, it tells us in verse 11, it happened one day that he came there and he turned into the upper room and lay down there. Then he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Call this Shunammite woman." When he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to him, "Say now to her, 'Look, you have been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?'" And she answered, "I dwell among my own people." All right, we have to pause. Verse 13 is a puzzler. Who is the king of Israel at this time? Who's the king? Remember, Ahaz is slain. His son, Ahaziah, falls through the lattice. He's dead. His brother takes over, and his brother's named Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, Ahaziah, Athaliah, Joash, It's not going to get there. Why? What's the problem? Those are the kings of Judah. So if you go this way, Jeroboam, Nadab. How many of you caught that? I'm not going to ask that. Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Omri, Ahab. Now it's starting to come clear. Ahaziah, Athaliah, Joash. No. Somebody help me. Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Omri, Ahab. What? Ahaziah and Joram. This is Joram. He'll be the king till about chapter 9 or 10 when he's slain by Jehu. Okay, so how do you explain verse 13? How can he speak on behalf of this king? What did chapter 3 say about this king, Joram? What kind of king is he? Do you remember how Elisha responded when they came and they wanted help in the battle against Edom? Verse 13. What have I to do with you? That's what he says to the king of Israel. That's what he says to Joram. And now this man concerning whom he asked the question, what do I have to do with you? You go to one of your prophets. He says, I have influence with the king. What's changed? What would have caused the influence? Joy? I would suspect that would have something to do with it. And incidentally, you will find there'll be one occasion in chapter 6 where he wants to kill Elisha. But the rest of it is that we have his bringing Gehazi in to say, tell me some more of the wonderful things that Elisha did. He can't get enough. He becomes his friend. And he repents for wanting to even to kill him. So he says, I can talk to the king for you. So he said, she says, no, I dwell among my own people. So he said, what it then is to be done for? Verse 14. And here's where Gehazi speaks up. And I don't know that he asked her this, but he did observe it and know this to be the fact. Actually, he said, she has no son and her husband is old. She has no son and her husband is old. So he said, call her. When he had called her, she stood in the doorway. And he said, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. She said, no, my Lord. Man of God, do not lie to your manservant. Maidservant. Do not lie to your maidservant. Okay, several things have piled up here. What can I do for you? Oh, I don't need anything. Why did she need a son? Her husband is old. She'd be all alone. What safety would there be in that? You remember Psalm 127? One of the reasons people had children was because of the solidarity. Ecclesiastes speaks about this. And because of the protection and the care they can provide. Psalm 127, verse 3. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is His reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. Now look at this. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate. You get this many around you, and they're not going to mess with you and your boys. And so that's what she needs, and that's what she's going to be given. And you remember in Genesis 34, when Jacob has come back from Padan Aram, and the young man finds himself enamored of Dinah and takes her without the brothers. I don't know what Jacob would have done, barring whatever help God would have provided there. But with those brothers, they overshot the care and actually destroyed innocent people too. But that's the attitude. You have the children in order to be blessed. You notice in verse 11, he's lying there on the bed and wants to know, what can I do for you? The blessing here comes to Elisha because she's assisting him. You might say a greater blessing comes to her because she chose to do that. It's like 3 John 5 through 8. Gaius is taking preachers in and he's supporting them. He's giving them food. He's sending them on their way. And he's one that being blessed. He's blessed more by doing that than they are by being with him and eating his food. And he's showing that he has a hand in what good they're doing. He's not going out and preaching, but he's supporting those who do. And that's what she's doing as well. And then one more thing here. You'll notice in verse 16, her reaction is one that we would not expect. Her reaction is, well, do not lie to me. Don't tell me. I can't have any children. But verse 17, the woman conceived and bore a son when the appointed time had come of which Elisha had told her. Now this is very similar to Sarah, who in Genesis 18 laughed when she was told, by this time next year, you're going to have a son. This history repeats itself. In verse 19, verse 18, the child grew and it happened one day that he went out to his father to the reapers. And he said to his father, my head, my head. Now when you put these together, the reaping during the hot time of the year and having a headache makes you think sunstroke. It could be malaria, it could be anything, but it makes you think sunstroke. I don't know. So he said to a servant, carry him to his mother. When he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon and then died. This is apparently a little boy if he's sitting on her knees. Someone had to take him to her. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God. Now, why his bed? Because he's about to come for a visit, and that's his room. And that's his bed, and he's going to do something great on that bed. And she shut the door upon him and went out. Then she called to her husband and said, please send me one of the young men and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and come back. He's perplexed over this. Why are you going to him today? This is an uncommon practice at an uncommon time. It's not the new moon. It's not the Sabbath. And she said, it is well. Do you have a footnote on it is well? No? Nobody? Sorry? It will be well. It's our word peace. In Israel, they say peace, peace, when in their greetings. And if you'll skip down to verse 26, is it well? Is it well? Is it well? It is well. All four of those times plus this one are the shalom. When you go to Israel, and that's a shalom, peace. That's what this is. Okay, so she said, it is well. Now, is all well? No, but it's going to be. It's as good as well because she knows what's going to happen. If she could have this son miraculously to start with, then she can have this son returned to her miraculously to end with. That's what she knows, and so her faith is growing even as the narrative continues. So in verse 24, she saddled a donkey and said to her servant, drive and go forward. Do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you. What's our expression for that? Put the pedal to the metal, right? I want you to go as fast as you can go and don't slacken unless I tell you. His tongue's lagging out, I'm sure, by the time he gets there. So she departed and went to the man of God at Mount Carmel. Remember, this is 17 to 25 miles and a lot of it is uphill. So it was when the man of God saw her afar off that he said to his servant Gehazi, look, the Shunammite woman, please run now to meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Peace with the child. She said, peace. Everything's fine. She's in a hurry to reach the prophet. She doesn't tell Gehazi what's wrong because her motive is to get to the prophet as quickly as she can and not waste time on the servant. So when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet. But Gehazi came near to push her away. Remember Matthew 28:9, the women at the tomb caught Jesus at his feet. When Jairus in Mark 5 goes to find Jesus, he falls at his feet. He has a daughter on the verge of death. She fell at his feet here because her son already has died. Gehazi came near to push her away, but the man of God said, let her alone, for her soul is in deep distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me. There were some occasions where God would inform the prophet about what has gone on. Jairus, for example, in 1 Kings 14, the king Jeroboam is going to send his wife to ask you how's the little boy is going to be, so you'll know. You tell him he's going to die. But here, he wasn't told. He didn't know. And so in verse 28, she said, did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? She can't bring out the words that her son has died. The best she can do is say, didn't I tell you not to deceive me? So then in verse 29, he said to Gehazi, get yourself ready. Take my staff. And remember, Moses took a staff and it did marvelous things. And he's expecting the staff to do something marvelous. But that's not going to happen this time without a human element involved. Get yourself ready. Take my staff in your hand and be on your way. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not answer him. But lay my staff on the face of the child. Why didn't he greet anybody? The Oriental greetings took a long time. And if you got slowed down doing that, it'd be like being on a 911 call and you see some friend over there. Say, hey, let's stop and talk to him. You don't do things like that. It's an emergency. Time is of the essence here. So, verse 30, the mother of the child says, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. You can send that servant anywhere you want, but I'm staying where you are. So he arose and followed her. Now Gehazi went on ahead of them and laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore we went back to meet him and told him, saying, the child has not awakened. Now imagine that mother's feeling at this point when they've already tried something that ordinarily you might think would work, but it didn't. That's gotten even worse. But where then Elisha came into the house, there was the child lying dead on his bed. Notice it says he was dead. He went in therefore, shut the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. Remember James 5:16, the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much in his working. So he went in therefore, shut the door behind the two of them, prayed to the Lord. He went up and lay on the child and put his mouth on his mouth. Very similar to Elijah in 1 Kings 17. He put his eyes on his eyes and his hands on his hands. He's warming the body. He stretched himself out on the child and the flesh of the child became warm. He returned. He walked back and forth in the house. He's gotten cold, apparently, so he's warming himself up some more. And again went up and stretched himself out on him. And then something that I've always wanted to see. I've seen Janet sneeze six times, I think, but never seven. But here's seven sneezes. The child sneezed seven times and the child opened his eyes. Now he's not dead anymore. And he called Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite woman. So he called her. And when she came into him, he said, pick up your son. Here's a miraculous birth that has been followed now by a miraculous resurrection. Here's your son. So she went in, fell at his feet. No speaking. I mean, what is she going to say? Words fail at this moment. All she can do is fall at his feet, bow to the ground. Then she picks up her son and she goes out. Now, we don't have time, but if you want to look ahead in chapter 8, verses 1 through 6, this miracle had such a profound effect. It was not forgotten. And later, when King Joram is talking to Gehazi, long after Gehazi has been diagnosed with leprosy, Naaman's leprosy, he's asking, tell me all these things that Elisha did, all these wonderful things. And while he's talking, he's mentioning this case of this woman's son who was raised from the dead. And lo and behold, this woman had been out of the country for 7 years, down with Philistines because of a famine. Elisha told her to go, she and her son. He looked up and there she was. He said, that's the very woman I'm talking to you about, and this is her son. And so it made a great impression on everybody. Any comments before we close? Okay, thank you very much for your help tonight.